This is Icon Art Radio, and I'm Bill Teeple, your host, along with Donna Colby and Alan Cobb. We had such a good time last week talking with Pam that we decided to have another session.
With Pam Whitworth, in case you didn't hear last week and you want to know Pam who?
Yes, Pam Whitworth. Well, we ended that show on the note of the solitude required to that the artist has to be jealous of their aloneness and their solitude and get over guilt about that, and also the fear of that, and go right in there and realize that the artist's life, in a way, is in the studio, it's very much a kind of you could say a lonely place, but I've gotten the handle on it myself from the recognition that it is the act of making art is very much just between you and God, and you're in this little cave all by yourself, with the other side being God, being the totality, but God breaking up into two sides. You've got the paper in front of you, and you've got yourself, and then something starts to happen. It's quite an alone type of experience, and that can get scary. It can be something that you want to run from. But if you embrace it, then this dialogue that starts to happen between within yourself in the context of acting it out on the paper is just where it all happens for the artist. And you go ahead, you were the one that brought this up, and I just started taking off on it.
Well, your takeoff, it makes me think of the artist Agnes Martin, and she talks about the need for solitude. And she's kind of humorous. She says, yes, the artists need solitude. You know, you should not have pets. You should not spend too much time with your friends. But she brings up this point that in that solitude, it's important for the artist to look at those things that they're afraid of. And that happens when you're alone. And especially when you're alone. For me, there's two things. One is alone and creating. Another is alone and just percolating. And I think it's important to have alone time when you're not doing anything. And it's very hard to find that time in our day and age. We live in a society that's compulsively busy, that's, you know, where the mind is completely hyperactive all the time. And to just sort of sit and look out the window and feel what you're feeling and get to know yourself more and more can be a difficult thing to rationalize to someone else and to yourself. You know, but that's the artist. The artist goes against the tide, you know, we're the radicals. And that is where a lot of our creativity begins, is in those quiet moments, because the creative process is all about truth. You know, it's all about truth of yourself and truth about life. And you don't access that by being hyperactive and running around all the time, you know, and then rushing into the studio and taking a few minutes and splashing something on and rushing off.
And there are stages to that solitude. As you were talking, both of you, before, I remember this quote from John Cage, and I very quietly tried to pull the papers out without making noise in the mic and found the quote. John Cage said, when you start working, everybody is in your studio. The past, your friends, enemies, the art world, and above all, your own ideas, all are there. But as you continue painting, they start leaving, one by one, and you are left completely alone. Then, if you're lucky, even you leave.
Perfect. And that's been my experience. I have a process that I go through when I start working, is that I start working on things and I don't like this and I don't like that and I mess up this and I mess up that, and I go for a couple of weeks, and you know, I'm getting more and more to the point of just thinking, oh, who am I kidding? You know, that was just a fluke. I'm never going to do anything decent again. I'm just, you know, getting more and more exasperated, and it's harder and harder to get in the studio. And finally, when I just feel like, oh, I've just had it, you know, I just am never going to be able to do anything else, that's when I start to do something decent. You know, it's true. It's sort of like I just completely give up and let go, and then something starts to move.
And does that sometimes happen when you're not in the studio, but like you were saying, sitting, looking out a window, going for a walk by yourself?
No, it's usually in the studio.
Is that in the studio? Because I think for me as a writer, sometimes if I'm struggling with some piece of writing and I just can't get to what I want to say, I'll put the whole thing aside, I'll let go, and I'll be in the shower or going for a walk or whatever, you know, sitting in the cafe, and then all of a sudden it just, everything kind of falls into place unexpectedly.
Yeah, for me it's kind of like Agnes Martin, you know, if I don't know what to do, then I just don't do anything. Mm-hmm. And I just sit quietly, and then within a usually very short time, something insists on getting manifested. Mm-hmm. And I think that's sort of, in a way, part and parcel of what you were saying before about the bringing out, you know, life itself into a work. Because I think nature, you know, even at its most fundamental level, I mean, the quantum field is trying to manifest. And as soon as you open a channel, something comes out. And the very first thing I ever heard Maharshi say about the purpose of the artist or the role of the artist was that exercise of having a very, very faint idea and then turning it into, you know, the Golden Gate Bridge or a painting or whatever, it's the opposite of the process of transcending, but it's the same channel. It's mm-hmm. just moving in the other direction. And in a sense, that's, in a, you know, sort of cosmic philosophical sense, the role of the artist, or one role of the artist, is to open that channel within his or her practice of art, and also to sort of expose that channel to whoever looks at the art.
Which is very true, I think, of your art, Pam, which is why, not only because of those white panels, but it felt like a temple when you walked into your show, because your pieces themselves are filled with that lively silence. They were very expansive, small paintings, but you looked at each one of those small paintings, and the inner effect when you're looking at them is that they are expansive. They take you to some vast silence. But it's a tickled silence with different flavors to it.
Well, it's interesting. You know, one thing that I try to do is pack as much sort of condensed energy in as I can without going overboard. And it's a fine line. I think, you know, I see Bill nodding his head. I think we're all familiar with that. That sometimes, you know, you start packing that in there, and sometimes you can kind of get so enthusiastic, you keep packing, and then you've gone too far, and it's too much. You know, you've broken up the simplicity, or it gets fragmented or something. So it's sort of like increasing the sort of tensile compression or something, so that it feels really that it's contained, but you still feel the energy. And if you push it too far, then you sort of split the container open, and then it gets diluted.
Well, so it's a real delicate balance. Mm-hmm. And that's why you go through all the stuff you described a few moments ago about in the studio. It's this sort of a harrowing roller coaster ride, actually. We all are familiar with that, all of us who have ever made anything. That you feel like you've lost it, and then you feel like you found it again, and then there it is. And it's all intuitive. As long as you're building a construction in your head as to what it is, then it's always going to be partial. It's not going to be total and holistic. But this tuning in, and yes, no, and until it feels just contained and balanced and there, that's what we do.
And it's learning to trust the feeling. You know, when I come from my head you know, and I'm thinking sort of as like clever design solutions, right. You know, that never works.
No, exactly.
That never works. It's real trivial and it just doesn't work. So, but that's that thing that we were talking about last week about, you know, your work teaching you things. I mean, this is what, I've learned these things, that I can have that tendency to push it too far. So I need to know how to deal with that. And often I work on a number of things at once. I have an idea, a red circle. I put a red circle down. Wonderful. I love the red circle, but it needs something else. I don't know what it needs. Do I push it then or do I wait? I set it aside. I start something else. Maybe I start a little doodle. It's nothing, you know. I set it aside. Maybe 2 weeks from now, I'll know the next thing to do with it. But so it's showing up and working. You know, Julia Cameron, who wrote The Artist's Way, you know, she says, you take care of the quantity. You know, you just show up and life, God, nature takes care of the quality. Mm. And for me, it's also, we were talking about kind of that razor's edge. One of the razor's edge that I have to deal with is this constant balancing between being and doing. You know, we were talking about, mm-hmm. Do you get it when you're just sitting doing nothing, or do you get it when you're working? And it's sort of this scales, this razor's edge. It's a template for my whole life, you know, is it enough to just be? Or, you know, I can get, like so many other people, get really caught up in feeling affirmed by how much I do. Mm. And so I go back and forth between those two things, just sitting, doing nothing, percolating, allowing myself to get more and more familiar with my interior world, allowing my senses to just soak in beauty around me when I get really confused. The best thing I can do is to just go outside or look at the sky, something. It just sets me right again. But you also have to show up. You have to have some discipline, you know. Even if you're frustrated, you have to just sit down and start, because you never know when something amazing is going to happen. So that's my challenge.
So when you reach that point you were describing earlier where you realize you've pushed it too far, what do you do? Do you tend to start over at that point, or do you tend to see if even within that piece there's something you could now do to put it back in balance again?
Usually at that point, I'm like so sort of emotionally off center, mm-hmm. that it's better to just set it aside.
Mm-hmm. Can you save it though? Do you get
yeah,
fresh?
I save it. I don't trash it right away. I save it.
Because sometimes some of the worst disasters, once you go through that surrender point, become the best pieces.
Yeah, you never know. You know, it might be redeemable, it might not. I don't know. And but I also know, like I said, at that point, I'm not a good judge either.
Right, yeah.
Well, at that point, you're not, no.
Yeah, so it's better to just leave it and start over. And because part of it is when you're working on something and you get too attached, you know, you feel like you're really close to completion and you really want to complete it and it's so good, and if you just do a little more, it's going to be perfect. And then you really blow it because you're coming at it from the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. You know, you want a product, you want a finished painting, you know.
Right, right.
And I just did one last week that was really great, and I'm just going to whip another one out. You know, doesn't work.
Yeah, I want that joy of completion. So I'm going to go for that. Whatever it is, doesn't really matter.
Right. But sometimes after I've really messed something up and set it aside, if I, you know, setting it aside kind of breaks something. It breaks that, you know, grip that you have on that. Mm-hmm. Now you sit down and you just realize that, you know, you're not in control. And when you try to be in control, you really just make big mistakes. So you sit down and you're just kind of in that very humbled space. And so you just start kind of playing around. And sometimes that's when that channel is just really open and clean. Mm-hmm. It's like you've just house cleaned and dusted out all that stuff that gets in your way.
Yeah.
And now suddenly, wow, it's like a gift, you know? you've let go, you've humbled yourself, you've said clearly that, you know, you can't push this to completion, and you get a gift. Mm. Something happens on the paper.
Well, it's probably great, too, that you have several pieces going at once, because then when you walk into your studio, it could be that maybe even for a few days, this one image isn't really resonating with the way you're feeling that day, but this other one is. And so you go in, you have options, and so that whatever you're feeling can come out. You're not forcing yourself to finish this one. Okay, before I go into the next one, I must finish the one with the red circle. You're allowing yourself to have fluctuations from day to day.
And I think it's important to kind of just accept how you work.
Yeah.
You know, what works for you. Different people work differently, and I'm a little more fragmented. It's hard for me to just sit hour after hour and focus and focus and focus. It's too exhausting for me. I think I must focus too intensely when I'm focusing. So for me to be able to work on something a little bit, put it aside, work on something else, put it aside, get up, have a cup of tea, come back, do a little here, do a little there. I used to sort of beat myself up about that, feeling like I didn't have stick-to-itiveness or something. But it's just the way I work. And so now I've learned how to work with that tendency, make friends with it.
Which sounds, as you were talking, more like incorporating music into painting, because you're going with the rhythm of your moods and the flow of, you know, the melody of the day and whatever, instead of something more formal.
Yeah. But I have to have it silent. Mm. I never listen to music.
Yeah. But the music that I was hearing wasn't...
Yes,
I know. Was the eternal, you know, music of life.
Well, we have a new touchstone now with Agnes Martin.
Yeah.
You can always refer in that direction, because the statement of just wait.
That's right, just wait.
And this is what you're describing.
She did say that one time she had to wait 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, I think it was even longer. So, yeah. 6 months she waited.
Do you have any desire, Pam, to try some other art form? Are you very, very feeling like this, the small gouache paintings, is your natural expression, or do you ever have a desire to work in some other medium or size? Or,
oh, I've had desires to work really huge at times. I just haven't had the space and the means. I forget, I think it's the movie Hero, you know, that Chinese movie where the calligrapher has a brush that's about, you know, a foot in diameter. And that's my idea of heaven. You know, I'd love to do just really wild, loose calligraphic things.
Ooh,
like that.
Man, let's hang a canvas in
Have you seen that movie? Are you familiar
with
it?
No, I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah, it's inspiring.
I could just imagine, when you said that, Pam, it was like,
brush.
I could just see Pam in there with this great big brush on the wall doing this wonderful thing.
Probably, you know, like 10 past lifetimes as a scribe in some Asian monastery somewhere.
So let's talk about a couple of the other aspects of your life while we have you. You began to do the pillow business, a decade ago, or how long ago now?
I think a little more than
And that. Was that something that happened out of pure spontaneous expression, making pillows, or did you have a contract to do it, or did you just decide this was a good way to try to...
Well, John and I had moved back to Fairfield, and I had had a little hiatus from working, but knew I had to, you know, be making some money. And here I was in Fairfield, and I just thought, oh my God, what are my options? You know, it at the time, it seemed a little demoralizing, you know, what am I going to do, you know? Get a job working at Walmart or something for $8 an hour, or be a, you know, receptionist somewhere. I knew that I was also in a period where I was feeling very more of a hermit than usual. The idea of like having to get up and go to work every morning just horrified me. So I thought I really needed to create something. I'd never thought of myself particularly as being a businesswoman, or never thought I would start a business, but I had done some interior design for a client of John's who had kind of an arts and crafts house and I had made some pillows for her from some old Asian textiles. She had a built-in window seat, and it just seemed perfect and very fitting for the period. And for some reason, you know, again, talking about how certain things come together at a certain time, just perfectly, some little light bulb went on, and I thought, maybe I could do this as a business, because I loved the textiles. So I just started making some prototypes, and of course, you know, my little naughty angel on my shoulder would whisper in my ear all the time, and I would just say no. That was why I think that it was just the perfect timing, because for the first time I could just say, no, I'm not going to think about that today. I'm just going to do the next thing, you know. And people would ask me what I was doing, and it was like, I couldn't get the words out, I'm starting a business. You know, I just couldn't say that. But little by little, I made these prototypes. We would, if we traveled, if we went to Washington, D.C. or New York, I would go to see people. And just little by little, I think one of the key things that happened is that a friend of a friend who was a business consultant sat with me for half an hour and said, what you need to do at this point, I had made some samples. He said, don't start to think about selling things. You'll feel overwhelmed. But take your samples, go to see some people in the business, and just tell them, I'm developing a product. What do you think? Ask them what they could sell them for. Ask them, you know, if you have questions about them, like I had questions, did they have to have a zipper? I was praying, no. What should they be filled with? Did it need to be feathers if they were high end? Ask them these questions, and then just be quiet. These people are the professionals. They'll tell you everything you need to know about your business if you give them the opportunity. So I took his advice. It was brilliant advice. And I went around, and these buyers just taught me a huge amount. They gave me wonderful advice. They sent me to other people that they thought would be great contacts for me. One woman in Washington took me aside and said, darling, you have to go to New York. Now get on the train tomorrow. I'll give you some names of people. Just go. Just do it. She was wonderful. She was fantastic. She was like an instant mentor for me. So the idea that I had that every buyer was sort of a dragon lady that was just waiting to make mincemeat of my ideas was completely wrong. They're looking for product, and they're delighted when somebody walks in the door with something to show them. So I had a lot of support in nature. One of my, my biggest all-time client now over the years, I found out, I read about them in an in-flight magazine, and I thought, wow, they sound like a store I would love, right up my alley. And I went to see them when I was in New York, and our aesthetic just totally meshed. So I've been doing things for them for many years.
But are you still mainly using Asian textiles?
Right? Yeah.
And speaking of Asian textiles, you have quite a collection of textiles, particularly kimonos.
Mm-hmm.
What else do you have in your collection?
Well,
just fabrics?
I have some fabric. Yeah, things that I've collected over the years. I've traveled a lot in Nepal, Tibet, so I have some things that I've gotten there. But mostly Japanese things.
So I might tell everyone that Mark Petrick and Pam will be curating a show of textile art, drawing from both of their collections, and maybe they will bring other collections into the show, since they're the curators at the Icon Gallery. Oh, it's probably going to be a year from now, but I don't know. We'll talk about that probably after the... where are we at now?
Pencil it life, in for life, 2008.
Life. Where are we at in life and time and space? I think this is early in 2007. I think we are.
Yeah. It is, Bill.
Yeah, we're talking probably, about spring 08.
Yeah, probably beginning of 08. We'll actually right set a date soon. In any case, everyone can look forward to that.
Yes, if you haven't seen Pam's pillows, they are absolutely exquisite works of art and a wide variety of personalities to these pillows, too. Do you sell them mostly in New York? And That's what I thought. Well, I should have my brother go and.
they're fantastic. What I like is that your integrity, the aesthetic integrity, has not diminished. That mm-hmm. you are doing a commercial product, but it's filled with this your love of form and function and
that's why I do them.
Yeah.
Are they one of a kind?
Yeah, they're all one of a kind.
See, that's so amazing to me because then you don't get bored making them if each one is an original. That's really great. So we're down to the last minute and 20 seconds. So before we end, I just wanted to thank Pam. This has been fantastic interviewing you. You've been like extraordinarily articulate and taken us all over to wonderful places and like you do with your art.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been really fun.
Well, I'm not sure when we could do a third show, but we haven't even talking about taking to wonderful places. Right. She's known for her trips off into the Asian realm, and we would love to hear more about that in another show.
Yeah, well, that sounds like an Odd Thursday presentation.
I think so. Yeah, would you like to come to Odd Thursday at Icon? And I think we could do this there.
Yeah, I think that'd be great with slides and everything. So,
okay,
keep looking at the paper and don't miss that, because Pam, you're really a great artist and great lady in Fairfield. So.
Well, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. All of you. It's been great.
Listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.